You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Martin Indyk, the Executive Vice President. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to moderate this first session of a new project that we are launching at Brookings in cooperation with JP Morgan Chase, which we're calling the Securing Global Cities Project. I'm very glad to have with us today General Ray Odierno and Mike O'Hanlon, who are the co-chairmen of this new project that is being organized under the umbrella of our Global Cities Project, which you can Global Cities Initiative, which has been a long-standing Brookings initiative run by our Metropolitan Program. The Securing Global Cities Project will be conducted under in our 21st Century Security and Intelligence Center. Paris, San Bernardino, New York, Boston, Mumbai, Kabul, Baghdad, Aleppo. Cities tend to dominate the headlines, particularly when it comes to the issue of security. And it is cities that have become more and more the drivers of whether it be economic growth or personal security in the 21st century. Indeed, we tend here at Brookings to see the 21st century as a cities-driven century. And that is the logic of the idea behind this Securing Global Cities initiative. Under this arrangement, we will develop a first-of-its-kind, data-driven, and expert-informed manual to help cities think through the key elements of an integrated security strategy to protect their communities and their citizens. It will incorporate experiences and recommendations from experts from around the world for enhancing security in major urban areas. The project will identify the different types of threats posed to global cities, as well as the best tools to address them, from reformed and strengthened police forces and justice systems to paramilitary and military institutions and intelligence capabilities. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to introduce you to General Ray Odierno, a true American hero, through almost 40 years of service in the U.S. Armed Forces, closing out that distinguished career as the 38th Chief of Staff of the United States Army. He is currently a senior advisor to J.P. Morgan Chase, and it's J.P. Morgan Chase that is providing the support for the Global Cities Initiative, of which the Securing Global Cities Project is a part. Brookings, if you walk in through our doors, was hard to miss it, since it's our centennial this year, places a high value on the quality of its in-depth scientific-based research, the independence of that research, and the impact that it has, particularly in the Global Cities Initiative, where we are engaged with cities across the United States and around the world in efforts to help their communities, help their economies grow, to provide real jobs for their people. And that insistence on quality, independence, and impact is something that our donors respect and admire, and the analysis and recommendations that our scholars make are also respected by them in terms of the independence that we insist upon. So, General Adorno, welcome, and it's very good to have you here. Next to General Adorno, we have Shashanka Menon. He is the former National Security Advisor to Prime Minister Manmohan Singh of India. He is a distinguished fellow both here in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings and at our Foreign Centre, Brookings India, in New Delhi. Next to him is Vanda Felbab Brown, a senior fellow at Brookings who has specialized in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency and has great field experience in understanding how cities cope with these problems. Her most recent book is Shooting Up, Counterinsurgency and the War on Drugs. Next to her, we're very glad to welcome to the podium here in Fork Ambassador Juan Carlos Pinzon. He is currently Colombia's ambassador to the United States, but he previously served for 4 years as Colombia's Minister of Defense, and in that capacity played a critical role in dealing with Colombia's security challenges, not just in its cities, of course, but in the countryside in dealing with the FARC. And he has been a critical partner to President Santos in the efforts to resolve that conflict successfully through a peace agreement. And finally, we have Mike O'Hanlon. Mike, as I said, is co-director of this project with General Adorno. He's also the co-director of the 21st Century Center on Security and Intelligence, a long-time Brookings Senior Fellow with a long list of books to his credit, the most recent of which is a fascinating book on the future of land warfare. So thank you all very much for joining us today. I'm going to give the mic to General Adorno to introduce the topic for all of us.
Well, thank you very much, Martin. It's great to be here with this distinct group of individuals, and I look forward to the discussion. As mentioned, as I started to get involved with J.P. Morgan, I became very interested in this Global Cities Initiative that has been established in the relationship between Brookings and J.P. Morgan. And what they were trying to do, obviously, was equip cities, businessmen, leaders of the cities, in order to deal with future issues, specifically on how you develop cities economically. And what caught my interest here is in my last 5 to 10 years of experience in serving in the Army and around the world, there's a couple of things that I've learned and I thought was important to this project as we look at future development. First, the one thing that is very clear, and everybody in this room understands, is I tell everyone the world is getting smaller every single day. And it's getting smaller because of how quickly information moves. It's getting smaller because people can interact very quickly. And it's changing the dynamics of how we develop as nations, how we develop relationships between nations, and how I believe we will develop each other in the future economically, diplomatically, and in a security perspective. I think it's important to understand that. The second thing is that there's many studies that will tell you that within 20 to 30 years, 70% of the population of the world will live in cities. And what that means is you'll have the development of megacities, where you have 10, 20, 30 million people in cities, but you also have developing cities of less numbers, but are just as important. And so I think it's important for us as we think about future development and future relationships that we understand the dynamics of cities and how that's going to change in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and how are we going to react to that. The final point I would make that I think is probably the most important is because of the interrelationship and the movement of information, there is now a constant interrelationship between economic governance and security, no matter where you go. 10 years ago or 15 years ago, there were probably more stovepipes when it had to do with security issues, economic development, and governance. But as information becomes more viable to all entities, they are becoming more and more interrelated every day. So it's important that we understand, as we want to develop the cities globally, whether they be U.S. cities or whether they be international cities, we understand that in order to gain economic development, there must be a security piece of that. And one of the things we want to look at is, what are the security challenges that we're going to face in the future? What are some of the things we can do to help us deal with those security challenges in the future? And those security challenges can range from terrorism, insurgencies, crime, and what my favorite term I like to use, just pure opportunists who try to take advantage of either no governance or lack of governance in order to have personal gain. And so I think a combination of these things are what we're going to have to deal with in the future. And then throw on top of that the developing of new threats such as cyber and other entities like that, and the ability to, and the more difficult it is to collect intelligence, and how do you do that in such a way for us to deal with the many problems that we will face in cities, not only here in the United States, but around the world. So for me, it's a very fascinating topic. And as we want to look at how we develop cities for the future, it'll be important that security is thought through in equal terms with economic development as well as how they are governed. So I look forward to the discussion, and again, I'll thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Ray. Shankar, you, of course, lived through the time that you were National Security Advisor, the most extreme terrorist attack in recent Indian history, which was in Mumbai, one of your largest and most important cities. So can you give us your perspective on this, the challenge of security when it comes to cities?
Well, certainly, Martin. I realize I'm here for the wrong reasons, because Mumbai has faced complex urban assaults by terrorist groups, well, now thrice in the last two decades. In fact, there were even more lethal attacks before 2008, in 2006, for instance. That, I think, is one of the major threats that we now face in urban environments across the world, because India is not alone in this, I think. Sadly, I mean, you mentioned Paris. You know, the list goes on, London, Madrid. It's a very long list. What did we learn from Mumbai, from this experience? It's interesting. Clearly, one of them is the risk of cascading failures in a situation where your infrastructure is increasingly integrated in an urban context. The general mentioned this, that how dependent we've become and how important it is to have responses which actually keep services and infrastructures going. But the other big takeaway that we got from Mumbai was that, frankly, if you think of why the terrorists are doing this, they're doing this to dominate the news cycle, of course, but they also want to provoke a disproportionate response, a highly militarized and disproportionate response. That's what gives them their oxygen. That's what empowers them. So don't give it to them. You need, therefore, a response which is much more sophisticated and goes across the board. It includes the economy, it includes society. And the fundamental problem is, how do you build a sense of community in these large urban, these megacities that we're building now, that the economy is actually creating, where you have newly urbanized conglomerations in India, in China, in Africa, and how do you build a sense of community? Because that's your only defense. You know, we used to say very proudly in India 10 years ago, there's no Indians in Al-Qaeda. We can't say it anymore. Today, we were proud of the fact that we know the Indians we know are in IS have actually been brought to our attention by the community or by their families who don't want to have anything to do with this. That shows the strength of feeling within the communities, within. But how do you build that sense of community without which, frankly, it's very difficult for the state to actually try and replace that or to perform the functions that communities perform for themselves? Second big learning that we had was the importance of preemption. That, you know, well, history is littered with fail-safe protective devices, the unsinkable Titanic, the impregnable Maginot Line, you name it. And especially for this kind of complex urban assault, I think the problem is defense is always on the defensive. You're reacting to multiple attacks in a short time frame across, and some of it unpredictable. So really preemption is the answer, which means you need the intelligence, and you have to then start walking this very fine line between people's freedoms and preemption. It's a hard line. The first law which accepted the idea of preemption in some form in India was after the Mumbai attack. We did a prevention of unlawful activities, which permits some amount of preemption with legal supervision. But that's a big issue for a society like ours, who wants to stay democratic, leave people's freedoms. But the intelligence is crucial for that, and that's very, very important. So I don't want to go on and on.
Okay.
But it seems simple. To me that...
So preemption is where you're actually arresting people.
Well, you need to get in there before the act actually happens. Now, any complex attack actually needs a fair amount of logistics, preparation. It needs all kinds. And so you actually have a better chance dealing with this kind of assault than lone wolf individual attackers who don't give you all the signals that you might get in these cases. The last problem, of course, in our particular case is that most of these attacks either require support or at least connivance from state entities of various kinds. And that's a real problem. So how do you convince states that this is counterproductive, that terrorist groups or these kinds of activities are not instruments of state policy and they don't work, that they actually turn back on their supporters and creators? We've done it before as an international community. If you look at chemical weapons, which at one time states thought were legitimate instruments of state policy, but we've managed to convince everybody that they aren't anymore, except a few outlaws. And I think we need to start thinking about how we start doing that, change the definitions of what's acceptable internationally. Maybe that's... I must say one other thing. If you look at the 2.5 decades when we faced these complex urban assaults, cross-border terrorism, these are also the 2.5 decades when the Indian economy did better than it ever had before. So it's a very strange relationship. And I put that down to the fact that we didn't overreact, we didn't over-militarize our reaction. And we chose, rather than militarizing the police, for instance, to create separate forces for particular tasks, while leaving normal community policing as a relatively unarmed police.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a whole set of issues which follow from this. I'd better stop here.
I just want to do a quick follow-up, though, on this first point that you made about the importance of
restraint.
Community.
Oh.
Restraint would come to, but community, because this is that you need to ensure that the community is not divided, right? That a divided community it helps those that would seek to undermine its security. That, I think, is a very interesting lesson. Funda, we go to the challenge from counter, the challenge to countering criminal activities. Why don't you give us a sense of what the dimensions of the challenge are there?
And indeed, in that respect, the issue of community is a crucial one, and it comes in many dimensions. And one of the defining characteristics of what's been happening with cities over the past several decades is great sense of bifurcation. Certainly enormous bifurcation between the developed, prosperous, and relatively secure core and vast slums where governance is delivered by non-state actors, whether they are slumlords or paramilitary groups or organized crime groups or in some cases insurgencies. But there are other divisions, other bifurcations occurring that are posing new challenges. You already highlighted some of them. One is cities versus the rest of the countryside. And in fact, divisions among cities. Increasingly in many parts of the world, we see cities within a country heading in very different dimensions, directions, economically, politically, and in fact, even with respect to foreign policies, although they are not necessarily the capitals. Nigeria, Lagos policies versus Abuja, for example, come to mind. So there is another bifurcation taking place. So it's the divisions within the city, the lack of sense of a community within a city, division between the city and the rest of the country, or even cities' relationship to other cities. And then the new dimension with that is refugee flows and migrants that we are seeing, who are often mistreated, marginalized, wrongly accused, made scapegoats, and deeply unintegrated. And so all these different bifurcations taking place simultaneously, sometimes cross-cuttings, often independent of each other, then bring really to the core the issue of who governs and who governs for whom. And here is where crime comes in. One dimension of crime is, of course, dealing with ordinary street policing that takes place in any city. Another dimension is organized crime, but the not new, but I would say increasingly prominent and fundamental element is crime as a source of governance. Crime as a source of governance in slums, but crime even as a source of government governance in non-slum areas. And this often intersects in complex ways with counterterrorism, and again comes back to some of the issues you highlighted. Namely, that some of the counterterrorism policies, even being adopted in the United States, go quite fundamentally against basic principles of community policing, not just civil liberties. That has then repercussions for crime and how we were used to deliver street crime and developing relationship with communities might be affected and negatively affected by counterterrorism policies. So a key dimension of securing cities will increasingly be both to deliver appropriate response to the appropriate settings, so to focus on what kind of criminality require what kind of responses. Dealing with street crime can involve very simple but very effective policies, such as in Bogota. We might hear about some of them from you, Ambassador. Or it might develop much more complex policies. But the policy specificity then also needs to be integrated to the bulk of security issues that cities will face. And I have not even mentioned other security dimensions, such as responses to natural catastrophes, responses to earthquake or flooding, and also responses of securing infrastructure and delivering basic services, which historically have been not delivered to slums or have been outsourced often by states consciously to organized crime groups or slumlords to deliver those services so that the state and those who are taxed, the elites or the middle classes, do not have to deliver them. And so one of the exciting things about this new project is to look at the different types of threats and try to pull some of the lessons and practices that can be shared, and looking at the complexity of the issues with great deal of specificity, but also with some lens toward integration.
So the heart of what you're saying about this challenge of governance is it's not just about policing, but it's about delivering services, that you have to do both.
Absolutely. Law enforcement is crucial, and I have often written about socioeconomic approaches to dealing with crime. But I always emphasize that without good policing, the socioeconomic approaches will not succeed on their own. So it's really about how legitimacy is created, how authority is delivered, and is there or is there not a sense of community. So effective strategies really require a bulk of interventions with right sequencing. The key difficulty for many of these policies is that they have to last for years and decades. And that means sustainability beyond administration and sustainability on the willingness of taxpayers to deliver those policies. And that is a very difficult commodity to come by.
Ambassador Pinzon, put back your hat on for a moment. Go back in time to when you were defense minister. You were also in charge of the police in that capacity. And how do you see it from the benefit of those days, the experience that you had there,
in terms of this challenge to security in cities?
Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation. I think that focusing on security about cities is critical. I really comply very much with what General Odierno said on how more and more cities are really the places where people is living more and more, and things are happening. So demand for security is coming out of cities more and more. So I value very much this idea, Professor O'Hanlon, of, you know, focusing your efforts here at Brookings on discussing on those regards. I've been trying to get away from my hat as Minister of Defense for a while now, you know, because it's a very wonderful experience, but at the same time, it was a long time commitment there, so I've been trying to become ambassador now. But I'll do my best, you know, to get the hat a little bit for a while, just to remind myself on some of the issues that I thought were interesting. First, just remind that Colombia is an interesting case when you discuss about security. Colombia was the most violent country in the world 15 years ago. It was not the most violent country in the region, but in the world. That was the reality of Colombia. We had the worst numbers for homicides. We had the worst numbers for kidnapping. And frankly speaking, our country was really in a crisis, which according to some made us almost a failed state. Story today, 15 years after, is an interesting one. We have the lowest homicide numbers in 40 years. In a study that won a very prestigious university from Mexico that releases every year, just 2 weeks ago they explained that for the first time there's no any Colombian city in the top 10 of the most violent cities in Latin America. So it proves, you know, how much things have moved forward. But at the same time, economics are very important, because what matters here is how much investment has resulted about this, economic growth, creation of jobs, and at the end, reduction of poverty. In the past decade, we have cut poverty in more than half. I think that's a little bit of the whole package, which is interesting to look at. By saying that, I believe that there are certain features that I believe are important to look at. During my tenure as minister, one of the experiences I'm still trying to understand was transition. We were transitioning from defeating a terrorist organization and, you know, organized crime in big scale, moving into getting regular problems like many other countries with organized crime in the cities, with gangs, and with the problems that somehow are the causes for youth to get into violence. And I think that perspective gave me some ideas that I think I can share with you today. First, we made some decisions on, I'm going to talk about three cases, Cali, Medellin. Why these two cases? Remember cartels. The largest cartels in the world used to have that name, Cartel de Medellin, Cartel de Cali, the most violent cartels anyone can remember. And then a city in the coast, Buenaventura, which is our largest port in the Pacific coast. Let me talk to you about these three cities. In these three cities, we were able to reduce, in the past 4 years, almost by half the homicides, the number of people that was basically killed by gangs, by conflict, or by any other kind of situation. Interesting to note that the kind of crime that we saw in these cities was not any more related to the big causes of conflict, but was more related to local situations, like gangs having control or gangs attracting, you know, communities in need, poor youth, you know, into violence. So we had to take several measures, and with this, I finished this first intervention. First, we increased policing in a substantial way. Both in Cali and Medellin, we increased police in one of the cities by 2,000 policemen, in the other city in some like 1,500 police, and in the city of Buenaventura, we made even a military police intervention. So increasing that kind of capability was necessary to show presence, to provide security, and to offer to the citizens the sense of presence that sometimes is necessary to create security. In addition to that, I think it was very important in these years the reform that was made in the Attorney General office. At the end, this is a justice problem. It's not a security problem. It's not a military problem. It is more a combined effort problem. So justice is critical. So we were able to increase the number of attorneys and actually, prosecutors, that's the right word in English, prosecutors by something like 2,000. And that was critical because that allows really to take into the legal process those who are on different kinds of crimes. Thirdly, we were able to partner from national level with local authorities. Believe me, it's mayors who really lead this. It's them who you need to work with. And at the end, they are the ones who lead their communities, have the resources to provide investment on activities like education, healthcare, or even jobs, training for jobs. That was very important. I mentioned particularly the city of Cali and Medellin because there we had a wonderful leaders, and they were able really to work in a way that providing security and taking the police and taking the justice was just a good set of conditions to do something else. And I believe that's important. Finally, President Santos made a very important decision, which was to increase the investment in education in Colombia. And actually, we set a goal that is very hard to achieve, but it's important to have it. We expect that by 2025, Colombia becomes the most educated country in Latin America. Very hard to get there. But it's important to have the target because it's the best way to offer alternatives to the people, to the young communities, and somehow move resources toward that end. Martin, I can talk about this, for hours because there are many things and details that you want to mention. But I believe these three features are interesting about these three cities, just to comment.
Can I just ask you a follow-up? The dynamic between city and country, as you resolve the conflict in the countryside with the FARC, is that what impact will that have on security in the cities?
Well, as much as you defeat those FARC, ELN, and somehow they got into the negotiations, some of the communities that were typically being recruited by those organizations, now that they are weaker, are staying in cities as gangs or being able to get into different type of criminal organizations. Organized crime is a challenge that Colombia has today, and it's a challenge we will need to confront for a while, even beyond this. So all this is interconnected in a way.
Mike, why don't you tell us a little bit about post 9/11 American city responses to the security challenges?
Thanks, Martin, and I also want to join you in thanking our co-panelists. I'm in awe of the talent on this podium today, including with my colleagues, but certainly with General Odierno, Ambassador Menon, Ambassador Pinzon. What you've done and what you've taught us already is remarkable. I just want to offer three principles that begin to occur to me in thinking through this question of what we've seen work in the United States and partly informed as well by experiences abroad. But just first, one broad motivation to echo General Odierno and Ambassador Menon about the sort of underlying problem we're dealing with and the challenge here. And again, the general said it very well, but we have a world that's increasingly urbanized. We're headed for 10 billion people on this planet by mid-century. And the good news is we've never been more prosperous. Globalization is working for more people than not. A lot of living standards are coming up. The bad news is we're living closer and closer together, which means we get each other's diseases. We are increasingly interconnected by infrastructure that may not always be up to snuff. And therefore, as Ambassador Menon said, we could have cascading problems. If one system starts to get in trouble, you may have a big population that no longer has water, electricity, sanitation, food. And these are dependencies that we're essentially creating or magnifying by our growth and by our improving living standards. But to the extent that we live on this sometimes rickety infrastructure, we're vulnerable. And so one of the aspects of this project and this broader policy question that interests me is when you marry up that kind of a world with security challenges, you can really see some potential for problems you hadn't previously perceived at the same scale. So yes, I'll talk very briefly about three principles, largely from the United States, but let me just offer one scenario or concept that could sort of drive this point home. We're all reading about the Zika virus these days and scared by that. We've watched previous health crises over the years with various kinds of viruses that came out of chicken stock in East Asia or what have you. But, of course, last year was Ebola, or a year and a half ago now. General Odierno was chief of staff of the Army when that crisis occurred and helped mobilize the U.S. response. I think, you know, overall I was impressed by how the world responded. But thank God that happened in a place that was not at war. What if it happens the next time in a place that is at war? And what does this mean for the way in which you deal with a health crisis and a security crisis that morph into one? And it's an incredibly imposing set of challenges, and it's the kind of thing we're going to try to get at in this project. But now to answer your question more specifically and concretely, I just would offer three principles that I think have been important in our response. And again, most people in this room have thought about this. Some of you have, I'm sure, been involved in responding to the challenge more directly than I. But one principle is that you need resources. There is just no substitute, as Ambassador Pinzon was just saying, as much of Vonda's work has reaffirmed, for having enough people at the local level to provide a presence, to provide intelligence, to provide reassurance. And this is not a problem. The problem of urban security is not one that you can skimp on. So I would submit to you, adequate resources is essential. And the adequate resources, the adequate resource problem is largely about human beings. Technology, you know, robots are not going to go around the streets of New York in 20 years and be able to get the same kind of human intelligence and do the same kind of community policing that police officers are. Automation and computerization and robotics may help, but this is fundamentally a demanding problem for human resources, and therefore it's expensive. And that's just a principle that I would submit has to be kept in mind in general. A second big challenge, and we see it in responding to counterterrorism concerns here in the United States, but it's, I think, true in many other places as well, and Ambassador Pinzon again got at this same kind of challenge for his country, is the need to marry up high-level national assets and intelligence with essentially what the cop is learning on the beat and on the street. You have to actually be talking real-time, day-to-day, combining those different levels of information, because sometimes a threat will first be discernible from the national intelligence level and sometimes more from the cop on the beat. And you've got to have both communities learning from each other and sharing in real time, which means that this is not a theoretical point you just write about in a book like a Brookings scholar might. This is something that has to happen and work on the ground in a matter of minutes and hours. And you need to build relationships and mechanisms that make this happen. I think New York City has been the best at this in the United States. We've seen progress in the Washington, D.C. area. We have a ways to go still. And then finally, and to some extent in the same sort of spirit, but making it more about the bureaucratics and the institutional issues here, and, you know, getting this right, figuring out what mechanisms are going to do the linkages is very difficult, and we have struggled. I think we're better now than we used to be, but let me, at the risk of offending, I don't want to offend because I think everyone's made progress in this, but early on after 9/11, we had problems with the FBI and joint terrorism or counterterrorism task forces working with local law enforcement, and there was not always an ability to decide what information should be shared. Highly classified information from the federal level that should be shared at the local level. I think sometimes at the local level, people knew more than was appreciated at the national level. And there was a real difficulty to the point where New York City, which probably would have done it anyway and needed to do it anyway, but it needed to create its own counterterrorism units because they didn't want to rely on the JTTFs. And over time, this has improved. But what it underscores is that you don't just need a certain number of resources. You don't just need the concept of marrying high-level intelligence with information on the beat. You need people and organizations that have sorted out the rivalries, the personalities, the turf issues of how to do it well. And that's going to vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. My very last point, one thing I've learned from my colleagues in metropolitan studies over the years, is how cities in general struggle to unify themselves at the right level of planning, because they're usually multi-jurisdictional. It could be in this area, of course, we have Washington, D.C., and then suburbs around it that are even larger in two different states. We have planning going on at the city, regional, state and national levels, and getting all these different entities to work together is a hard problem that's going to vary from case to case. So in this project, I know General Odierno and I were hoping to actually collect best practices, lay out some general principles, but recognize that individual cities are going to have to find out how to apply these general concepts and principles to their own circumstances, which will always be different from case to case.
Thanks, Mike. I'd like to come back to talk about the organizational issues and draw on Ambassador Pinzon and Shankar Menon and General Adjorno's experience in terms of the organizational side of it. But first of all, I want to focus, General, on your own experience leading the counterinsurgency campaign in Iraq, being responsible for the surge and then commanding overall forces. A lot of that had to do with fighting in cities. Can you tell us some of the lessons you draw from that
experience? A couple of things. So the lesson I drew out of this is there's limits to military power. And so no matter how good you think you are, how much capability you have, you can't accomplish everything with military power alone. It's got to be integrated with good governance, and it's got to be integrated with creation of jobs and economic development. And if it's not, it's going to be really difficult. The second piece is that from a security perspective, you have to be among the people. You have to gain trust of the people in order for them to provide them the adequate security that is necessary. And they have to see you as someone who is the honest broker out there who will help them resolve their problems. The other thing is the incentives of those who are creating instability, and I call it instability because the incentives how they create instability are different. Some are incentivized by they have a movement, which is somewhat of an insurgency. Some are incentivized purely by money. Others are incentivized purely by power and the ability to control others. So you have to understand what the incentives are and what are they trying to accomplish. The final lesson we learned is that in order to defeat or be successful in this environment, you need a network of activity to defeat a network of problems. And it gets back to this, again, I go back to you have to go after the money. If there's an insurgency, you have to cut off the money of the insurgency. You have to limit their popularity if they are providing jobs or providing money to citizens. And you have to provide alternatives to the citizens. So it's this inner workings that I think are so important. And all of what I just described probably happens in most major cities in the United States and outside the United States. It just happened to be where I was at. It was encompassing the whole country. And a lot of it had to do with a failing government or failed governance to start with. But so those are the major lessons that we learned. And I think it's important as we look to the future and how we help governance in cities to prevent this from happening. And the comment you made about being proactive, about getting ahead of it, is really important. Because what happens if you wait too long, it's so far out of control, it becomes very difficult to bring it back and provide what you need to.
Can I just ask you on the sure. kind of bureaucratic, organizational side of things, the lash-up between local forces, intelligence agencies, National Guard, Army and so on. Is there a best practice in that regard?
There's always a problem because people are concerned about who has overall. So it's always about who has overall responsibility, who responds to who. So the most important thing is you got to communicate. You got to get people in one room. They got to have a ability to voice their concerns, and then you decide and divide up whose responsibilities are what. And you understand who is overall responsible. If you're able to do that, it can work. And it depends on where you are and where you're at, how difficult that problem is.
Okay, you got comments on either of those issues in terms
I think the general is absolutely right. The key is really the governance and is getting ahead of the problem. In both respects, in terms of mitigating what might have happened, making sure that infrastructure services are restored as quickly as possible, people can go back to normal lives, but also in terms of preventing what's trying to come at you. And there, I think the hardest part in our experience is really the coordination, to get intelligence agencies to talk to each other, to make sure that you, exactly what Mike was saying, that what the beat policeman knows very quickly and instinctively, that that's shared. After Mumbai, we set up a whole set of institutions where essentially we too share intelligence and do this. But it took them a long time to develop the habit of working. I mean, it wasn't as though you could just order this and it happened. No, it took a lot of practice of working on small daily issues to actually build up. Now, it's very difficult to do that in the kind of situation that the general faced, say, in Iraq and so on. So you have to do it before you actually face the event. If you haven't done it before, then you're actually, it's almost too late.
But don't you worry, it's a large, chicken and egg. Unless you have the terrorist attack to motivate that kind of cooperation, it's very hard to get that cooperation.
We've had enough terrorist attacks, quite frankly, to incentivize people. And I think people know now. That's not a problem. Awareness today, across the world, wherever you go, this is something that really worries people. But are we capable of dealing with this? How do we deal with it? So I think the manual that you'll be producing is really essential. It's very, very useful.
If I could just show this important, I skipped it, and I'm so happy you brought it up, is this importance of infrastructure. I can't overemphasize the importance of infrastructure. The ability to deliver basic services, whether it be delivery of water, delivery of electricity, policing, all of that infrastructure is critical to maintaining security and then and economic development, or creating economic development, which increases security. And one of the lessons that we learned, and again, Iraq was a very different place, but we spent a lot of time on infrastructure. But where we failed was, after we built infrastructure, we didn't have a governing body to turn it over to. And so, in other words, the people that were in Iraq or in Afghanistan weren't ready to accept that infrastructure, so they couldn't sustain it over time. So the money we invested ended up not actually feeding the population in such a way that developed a relevance type of infrastructure they could believe in. And so that gets back to this intersection between governance and infrastructure, governance and security, governance and jobs. That's so important.
Ambassador Pinzon, is there lessons from Colombia's experience in terms of dealing with the organizational challenges?
Well, first of all, I think that General Lierno mentioned something that I always listen from my own generals, and I respect that very much. Typically, you will think that servicemen will tell you that the solution for a security problem is going after the bad guys, and defeat them. And frankly speaking, the more sophisticated they get and the more experience they get, the advice that they will give you is that security, requires an integrated effort, a set of policies at the same time that happen in a way that really you change environments. I think that's a little bit of the lesson that we are getting in the case of Colombia. No doubt, you need, in case you're confronting an insurgency or an armed structure, you need a military action to defeat them, to confront them. Afterwards, immediately, you need a policing capability that provides some confidence to the people, some sense that they are protected. No doubt, you need justice in a way that people can solve their problems without confronting each other. But no doubt that then you have to discuss about the illegal economies that typically are funding the different types of violence. Sometimes, in the case of Colombia, it's very evident, it was drug trafficking. More recently, illegal mining or extortion or any other type of crime. But usually, those economies are fed by very young communities without opportunities. And there is where you need to offer people different policies, different set of alternatives. I said it before, on education, on job creation, or on any other kind of alternatives that really give stability long term. So that's a bit of the experience. And the challenge is that now this is happening in the cities, and there are slums in the cities, and there are different kind of realities that are happening that require, as I mentioned before, and it's very important, engage with locals. I think Michael mentioned something that you got a bit from our own experience as well. Yes, at national level, national institutions, or even international organizations, you tend to make an intervention to solve all the problems and to bring everything. But one day you will leave, while the population there will stay forever. And they require their own governance, their own system to be organized. There will always be a mayor. There will always be some kind of leader or, structure. In the case of Colombia, of course, we have a constitution. We have our laws that have implications on how our cities are organized. But then you have to prepare them to lead and really, you know, make them not only capable but responsible to take over. In the cases that I mentioned, particularly in Medellin and Cali, frankly speaking, those are large cities in Colombia, will be large mainly any place in the world. But the success that I found in these past 3 years, 4 years working with them, was that the mayors were really effective leaders. They were leading the security, but they were leading the whole set of policies in a way that our support from national government was really connected to what they were needing. So that partnership resulted in effective results. That's what we've experienced.
Very interesting. Funda, I would welcome your comment on this, but you have an expertise in dealing with failed states or failing states that don't have the capacity to respond in the way that everybody's been talking about now. So what do you do in those circumstances?
Well, thank you. I was going to add to that, and in fact, failed cities. I mean, we heard several times that we need to get ahead of the curve. The reality is that in major urban areas, there are many parts of the city, often the largest part in terms of the number of people who live there, but also territory, that have been left behind decades ago. And so integrate
behind by the governments,
by the more privileged members of society that don't have basic services, that don't have legal water delivery, that don't have job creation, and that are increasing in size. Most of the migration from the rural areas is not taking place into the well-policed centers of the cities with high skylines and skyscrapers. It's taking place into slums. So the population of those failed cities, quote-unquote, is really where the bulk of urbanization is taking place. And, of course, all the resource issues are enormous. They often have to deal with basic social contract issues in the country. Who is willing to tax itself to provide resources for those left behind? Those are major challenges. Even in the very richest areas, Medellin and Cali are some of the very prosperous areas of Colombia, and the resource base available to them is not replicable in other parts of Colombia, just as the resource base in Monterrey, one of the successful or often highlighted as successful case in Mexico in dealing with violent criminality, is not available in other parts of Mexico. Cities don't have money, and even when they have money, it requires decades-long willingness to increase taxations on the rich and the middle class to provide for the poor. And often that willingness evaporates as soon as violent criminality goes down and stops encroaching on the city center. So I would say that the resource issue is huge and not easily overcome. Local leadership, of course, varies enormously. And often there are explicit or at least clandestine contracts between the elites and outsourcing out of rule and governance and services to other actors, to non-state actors. The lag getting ahead of what in many cases is catching up on decades of malaise that's only being exacerbated is the real issue.
Please.
I might just bring up something that I think we're missing in the discussion, which I believe operational is very relevant, is the use of modern technology for surveillance. You know, that's a big difference these days as compared to any other time in security challenges. And, for instance, the use of security cameras, for instance, are very useful not only to provide some kind of security, more efficient use of policing resources, but at the same time offering good quality information for justice and for investigators. So I think that's another tool we have these days, that when you use it in an effective way with the right set of command and control centers, but at the same time connected with justice, suddenly it provides effectiveness. I think you might know better than I do about this, but London typically is used as a case of study on how you can do well in the city.
Right. And cameras, of course, are specific to cities. No point in having cameras in the countryside.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
So, but let's look at this question of surveillance and privacy. Shankar, you brought it up as well. How do you find a balance? How does the Indian government
I think
find
each society defines it differently for itself. I mean, that's something that society has to choose. The problem is, how do you make that choice? How do you make it possible for a society to make that choice, to understand where you're drawing the line? Because when you just say, I'm going to connect all the surveillance cameras, traffic, whatever, throughout the city and make it available to the police, that's unobjectionable. The question is, how do you then supervise the use of those cameras? How do you prevent other people from tapping into it and using it, including, I mean, the terrorists and the criminals from using it? That's something that, frankly, I think each society has to do for itself. I don't think there's one rule that you can lay down and say, okay, here it is. But I wanted to raise a slightly different question. How do you define victory in these things? You know, we were all brought up, taught in military academies, wherever, that, you know, either you fight it like a war. A war is a war is a war. You fight the enemy, defeat him, annihilate him. Or else you're taught the other extreme, which is you have to win his mind and his heart, and, you know, which is, okay, these are sort of, that's the classical theory that we're all taught. But that's not what we're dealing with here. What we're dealing with is mowing the grass. I mean, we don't have a solution for these things, for these situations that we're facing. You mentioned one reason why, because there's this constant stream of migrants coming into the ungoverned parts of these cities, and it's a very complex problem. So I think we need to, you know, start setting ourselves standards that we can really meet, rather than saying, we're going to solve this problem. If you do the following things, in the next 5 years, you won't have a problem.
Define mowing the grass as you understand it.
Well, mowing the grass means we have this problem. The grass will keep growing, but you have to keep mowing it, whether you like it or not. And you have to learn more and more efficient and painless ways of doing it. And the better you get at it.
You know, but the challenge of that is that the society, the people that you're dealing with, have to be prepared to accept mowing the grass a level of insecurity.
But I actually think people are cleverer than we are. I think it's the experts who confuse them and tell them that they have solutions. But anyway, that's a different argument.
This conversation and the previous one very much gets issue at who has trust and who has authority
right.
the communities. And the key problem, both in many cities with large slum areas, but also in many cities that are facing new influx of refugees, is that large segments of the population do not trust the official state authority. They see police as abusive, and often police are the best criminals on the block. Their security is provided by non-state actors. Often the criminals, the organized gangs, provide far better human security than the formal or police military forces. So there is this a priori, often this junction between trust and security, which is not overcome by technology. The technology provides greater intelligence feed, but does not really resolve the issues of trust and authority and legitimacy. The other issue, and that's very much, again, linked to the trust, is then deploying socioeconomic policies, whether in the context of counterinsurgency or counterterrorism or in the context of highly violent organized crime, in combination with law enforcement. And the reality is, of course, that the whatever design of policing strategy is deployed will likely produce some sort of effect much faster than any socioeconomic approaches. And often for socioeconomic approaches to work, we're looking at years or realistically decades of sustained resources, whereas the expectations are much faster and often the policing is not sustained. And crucially, the jump from counterinsurgency type policing to anti-crime policing is very difficult. And even cities like Rio de Janeiro that have been experimenting with programs like SPAE or UPP have not resolved the jump. They come into highly violent areas with military or military police, but really struggle to transition to community police and enormously struggle to transition to any sustained legal economic growth, creating employment so that legitimacy is transferred to the state. And in that sense, those struggles and difficulties mimic some of the counterinsurgency and counterterrorism issues. Some. I don't want to overdraw the parallel.
Well, following a little bit of the two previous comments, what is victory? It's always a question that never has an easy answer or fast answer. You know, I believe that's important. I think in the case of Colombia, we are getting precisely onto that discussion, but I would summarize it in the following way. We were able to reduce the size of the problem to 30% of what it was 15 years ago. So the size of the FARC, ELN, and, you know, crime in general is 30% of what it was. So reduction of crime, reduction of the criminal capabilities is a little bit of a signal. But second, in the case of FARC and ELN, was making us to the possibility of getting into a peace agreement using political tools, which was unthinkable before. And I think that's a little bit of how you craft this idea. No doubt, victory in this kind of counterinsurgency, counterterrorism campaign is not something like the old conventional warfare concepts. It's a little bit more a mix of security and political discussions, which I think is what we are putting together. And on the matter of trust, which I think Wanda has is very keen on that, I think it's absolutely true. You require, first of all, the credibility of institutions that are on the field to be effective. You know, people need to believe on them, need to trust them. And in order to do that, unfortunately, you have to be very effective at the same time on controlling your own institutions. So one of the things we have done in the case of Colombia many, many times is getting rid and taking to jail and to justice those members of the service who has misbehaved. I think that has created a lot of legitimacy in Colombia to the level that the institutions that had the highest regard by Colombian people on any poll usually are the armed forces or the national police. I think that's very important, which implies that you only need to do more. I was just reading the paper yesterday, and in the city of Bogota, our capital city, were captured 14 members of the police that were related to a microtraffic gang. Good news. Well, it's a sad story to know that it happens, but it's good news to continue to create the trust and go after corruption and misbehavior. That's necessary and that's critical.
Interesting. So we're going to go to the audience for questions in a minute, but I just want to give Mike a chance to come in if you wanted to on this subject.
Thank you. I'll be brief. I wanted to pick up on a point about technology, because this raises the question that we're all wrestling with in the United States about issues of personal privacy. And, of course, we're also learning more and more about what we didn't know and couldn't have known about the Paris attackers and their ability to use new kinds of apps to have their communications be encrypted and secure. And there's been an ongoing debate as well between DOD and the intelligence community on the one hand, with Silicon Valley and others On the other hand, over the last couple of years, about whether we should be building in backdoors to new software, we're all familiar with this debate. I think the administration, to some extent, has conceded that it doesn't really know how to mandate this, and even if we did mandate these, that would create vulnerabilities in our software. So in a sense, we're potentially losing certain tools that we once had. And because all the threats we're talking about are serious, especially, I think this is especially relevant to terrorist networks and to cartels and transnational criminal networks more generally, where there are a lot of communications within the organization. We're going to have to try to use big data and correlations and tracking different lines of communication if we're not allowed to use small data, which means access to the actual communication itself. So count me as a, I'm not trying to sound like an Orwellian, but I think we have to be a little careful about not being just civil libertarians. We should preserve our civil liberties, of course, but be aware of the need for intelligence. And one last point that's related, although it's not about technology, it's about the cop on the beat, and it's the whole issue of profiling. And again, I don't want to sound politically incorrect, and I'm not necessarily in favor of profiling, but we have to let police get into the neighborhoods where the crime is the worst, and that's where the crime needs to be stopped, and that's where the intelligence networks need to be developed. And this is not trying to make an apology or create leniency for bad policing. We obviously need to be very severe about punishing bad policing and very protective of individual rights. But in this year where we've had so many problems with police issues in the United States, we have to bear in mind, I think, that a key principle is going to be we have to keep the police in the neighborhoods where things are the toughest, and we can't overcompensate for some issues that have been very troubling, where some very bad things happened, but go to the point where we don't allow the police to do their job in some of these tougher neighborhoods.
Okay, let's go to your questions. I would ask you, after I call on you, please do three things. One, wait for the microphone. Two, identify yourself. And three, make sure you ask a question. Okay. So please, gentlemen over here.
Thank you. My name is Alex Paul. I'm from the Atlantic Council. I wanted to ask about a subject that's affecting all European cities, including the one where I'm from, London, which is that, you know, these cities, and this is something I think the US has maybe had more success at than we're having in Europe, but cities thrive on openness, the flow of people into them, migration, you know, the new ideas they bring with them, and multiculturalism. So how do we encourage this dynamic whilst balancing this with reassuring the people that already live there and the citizens of these places that migration is not a security risk and the answer is not to shut our borders? Thank you.
Right, you want to...
Well, I mean, I think so. First, I think it's how you integrate them into your society. To me, that's probably the most important point here. I think the world that we live in is going to continue to have a huge refugee flow for the next several years as I look around the world. So we all have to face this problem. But I think what you can't do is allow them to come in your country and then segregate them. Segregate them by where they live, segregate them by what rights they have, segregate them by what jobs they can hold, segregate them about what they can do. I mean, you know, I'm not going to go into a lot of depth, but I tell the story as my grandfather came here from Italy, and I became the head of the United States Army. There's not too many places, other countries, that happens. But because I was given the freedom, and he was given the freedom and opportunity to do what was ever necessary and gave me that opportunity. So that's how you solve this problem, is you have to allow them to be totally integrated and not segregate them. And so we're going to all have to face this issue. And we're facing it in the United States. We have our discussion on immigration. I don't want to get into the politics of immigration. But the bottom line is we got to make sure we give the people the ability to completely integrate and give them the opportunities that everyone else has. And then I think it'll help us to solve the problems.
We have a situation now where I think the number is like 30 governors don't want refugees to come in, mayors also don't want them in their cities. Do the refugees present a security threat?
Well, you know, it's like everything else. I mean, I think the large majority of them, my guess is, will have no security threat at all. Is there one or two? Probably. But we have to figure out how to deal with that. And the answer is not saying, in my opinion, I don't want to get too political, but you can't come into my area.
Donda?
I agree very much that the issue of integration is key. Realistically, first of all, most refugees are victims under terrible circumstances. And not for one minute, I think we can and should lose focus on our moral responsibility, our empathy for the people under terrible circumstances. It's imperative of us as human beings. It's imperative of our history. That said, if integration fails, and integration is has been a major challenge in Europe, in places like France, then communities become easily vectors of alienation and vectors of criminalities and potentially linkages to terrorism. Often it is the second generation that is more susceptible to recruitment than it is even the first generation. And there are so many aspects to policing. The answer, the question is too many sort of complexities to give a quick answer, but let me give you an example of a failed integration in the United States, which was the rise of large Latino slum areas in places like Los Angeles with vast criminality there, the response of which on the United States part was to then imprison many of the young men and export them back to countries such as El Salvador, Honduras, thus creating the maras and pandillas, which in their lethality and which in the level of threat they pose to the states resembles insurgency. So U.S. policy there was one of failed integration, criminalization, and export then of those problems back to home countries, with ultimately leakages coming back to the United States. So integration is key. How one goes about that is difficult. The second generation often is trickier to engage with appropriately, to develop appropriate policing. But here is where the issue of counterterrorism and the integration of counterterrorism with community policing becomes clear. If counterterrorism becomes about very aggressive phishing and very aggressive sort of de facto entrapment, that might be seductive in terms of effectiveness in the short term of preventing or disrupting perhaps immediate terrorist plots, but can be very destabilizing and counterproductive in the longer term as the community stops cooperating with the police. So developing local police forces, recruiting among the refugees, among the migrants, so they become members of policing, police forces, is one of the crucial dimensions, and being very sensitive to the needs of the community, to protect the community from crime as much as to focus on any potential vectors of terrorism.
Okay, there was a lady in green here, easily identifiable.
Speak very loudly. Oh, great. I'm with the U.S. Small Business Administration, regional administrator, previously city planner. So for me, it's really important to look at the generations, especially the younger generations, because in a lot of these cities, you have a lot of people under 25 years old. And when we talk about economic development and we're trying to create a platform where businesses can be started, entrepreneurship can be, you know, pushed and helped, I think that there's a lot to do with as you develop city, as you look at the crime and infrastructure, you really have to look at the data on what is affecting this younger generation. Because, you know, for example, in Mexico, 25% of the population is under 25 years old. So there's a lot of that type of data I think is very important for us to look at as you look at your studies and your conversations.
Interesting point, Ray. You had to deal with this problem in Iraq, of course.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. And what you have to, you know, first you have to understand what are they looking for, and you have to understand what do they want. And you have to do that analysis. I mean, you always start with education. Do they have fair education opportunities? And after they have education opportunities, do they have fair job opportunities? But it's not that simple. We all know that. And so it's important to understand it. Because what happens is it's also about having a sense of people who you can look up to, family or somebody outside of the family that develops the right values. And once you start that, you're going along the right path. So we have to do is have programs that allow us to do that, in my opinion. Because if they become disenfranchised, then it leads to, I mean, you just pointed out. I mean, you just talked about what happens if we don't take care of this problem. And that's why second generation is they've now lived through, and by the you get to the second generation, they turn to violence, they turn to illegal activity, in order for them to survive. And so we have to be very aware of that. And in my mind, that problem is going to get worse as cities grow and as the slum, where that was stated earlier, they're going to go to the slums in the cities. And how you deal with these populations is going to define overall security and economic development. I think that's the kind of things we have to make sure we look at as we do this study.
Shankar, you want to speak on this? Okay. Antoine.
Antoine von Akmal, Brookings Trustee. I wanted to ask both General Ageno and Mr. Menon about a ticklish issue that I think is associated with otherwise critical and important policies, sharing intelligence and providing basic services, as you mentioned. Because the first one opens up the risk of people infiltrating you as opposed to you infiltrating them. How do you deal with that in your experience? And then the second question about basic services, associated with that is the risk and the reality, I think, of corruption, which has its own corrosive effect. So could you, I mean, you have both dealt with these issues in practice. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I think one of the I'll talk for the United States specifically here. One of the biggest problems we have is sharing of intelligence. And frankly, in my opinion, our ability to sometimes deny us sharing intelligence really hinders us in developing the appropriate relationships that are necessary to solve many of the problems that we're facing. And so we have to do a better job of resolving, you know, because for the most part, I believe we can share most of the intelligence that we get. And we got to figure out how we do that. And it can be specific to a situation. It could be specific to a city. It doesn't have to be necessarily national level, but it can be very specific to the problem that we're finding. So I think that is something we have to get our arms around and do a much better job at. We can protect ourselves against the infiltration, I believe. I think we can figure out ways to do that. And frankly, most of it will not harm us because of the level of intelligence that we would provide anyhow. Corruption, in my mind, is so endemic, and it's societal. What I found is it's part of the normal way of doing business. And so it's really hard to break it in a society because their father did it, their grandfather did it, their great-grandfather did it, and it's been going on for a very long time, and it becomes an endemic part of society. So getting them to educating people to understand how devastating this is in terms of resources and in terms of pouring it back into the population is an education process and a real challenge. So I haven't solved the problem. I guess I'm agreeing with you that it's a huge problem. And we've tried to solve it in so many places, and we make some progress, but not enough.
Well, on the sharing of intelligence, I entirely agree with you. I speak only for myself and my experience in India. After Mumbai happened, we sat with all our friends, the US, the UK, everybody else, and we put together what we knew before. And it turned out that if we had actually done that exercise properly beforehand, we'd have had a much better idea of what to expect. Maybe not 100%, but, you know, we'd have been much better prepared. So we learned from that experience, and I think we do better now in terms of what we share internationally among ourselves. It's much harder to do it domestically, to actually get everybody, and the creativity that's shown in not sharing is incredible, if you actually look at it. But I think, you know, it's experience is the best teacher, ultimately, when you suffer, when as a result of not having shared. And today, I think we're certainly better off than we ever have been before. But it's a constant battle. It's something that we just have to do. And I don't think there's any one structure or one system. We tried an NCTC kind of structure. We tried MACs. You know, yeah. We have them at various levels. All kinds of things. Many of them we learned from the U.S. But I can't say it's perfect yet. But it's better than it's been before. And I think, frankly, we'll be forced by necessity and experience into doing better at this. Corruption, the problem is that corruption is the real cost of the service. There isn't enough of that good or service or whatever to go around to meet demand. And what corruption does is it charges the extra bit. So in economic terms, it's a very hard thing to attack and solve. It's not something that you can do just by education or by appealing to people's morality, their good nature, or even by coercion. I mean, it's because ultimately it's the economics of it that's driving it. And the only solution to that is to increase supply to the point where you can actually meet demand. And that's not something you can do overnight. So for me, that's the problem. The problem is, therefore, that's why I said you don't have victory available in the sense of I'll eliminate, but you can reduce it to manageable proportions, concentrate on the places where you don't want corruption, certainly in intelligence, for instance, and, you know, security. These are areas which you have to keep clean, and you have to provide the supply, which is exactly what he was saying. You need to get the policemen, you need to... But that's the way I look at the problem. I don't think that's a very good answer, but at least...
If I could just add one thing about sharing of intelligence. Really, a bigger issue is today we have so much information. It's 10, 20, 30 times what it was 5 or 10 years ago, the amount of information that you have. And the most difficult part is sorting through the information. So, for example, when we know something already happened and we go back through it, we find, we did have this information. But frankly, in a lot of cases, we didn't know and we didn't get it to the right people. And so this idea of big data and how we use big data to solve complex problems and how we get the right information to the right people at the right time is almost as critical as sharing intelligence information. So for me, that's becoming a bigger problem for us as we deal with some of these issues.
Ambassador, do you want to come in on these questions?
Well, for us, sharing intelligence became one of the sources of success. And when people, you know, the system, the agencies, learn about the benefits of sharing, somehow they got good incentives. But I have to tell that by 2006, 2007, we were not able at that point to even get to one of the high-value targets of the FARC, ELN, or the criminal bands. Starting then, we came one by one. And what was the answer? At the end, we created a system in which we gather all the intelligence agencies to share, you know, what they had, to, you know, create a community of information, and somehow success brought a good incentive to continue to do that. I think that was useful. And later on, it worked the same way for to detect terrorist intentions. Particularly by 2009, 2010, we detected that there were going to be responses from those organizations against cities and certain cases. And, you know, that system of gathering intelligence and sharing somehow became the way to contain that to happen. I have to confess that that's very difficult to sustain. You know, the incentives for people to be the one who really gets success and not sharing that success with anyone else are very high. But the risks of not sharing are, at the same time, very consequential for state and for cities in this case that we're talking. So it's very important to work onto that culture. In my opinion, it's not a thing that you can just say you have to, because everybody knows you have to. Sharing. Everybody talks about sharing. But how do you do it? Well, it requires leadership, and it requires culture, and it requires time to really make that happen. I think, as of now, some successes in Colombia prove that worked, but it doesn't mean it will continue forever, so we need to keep working on that.
I think we have to go to the last question, and this gentleman here.
Hi, my name is Navita Malford. I'm a local teacher here in D.C. in a high-poverty school, and my question is about drug legalization. When I talk with a lot of my students, they come from very poor backgrounds, and they face a lot of drug violence. And some of my students buy drugs, some of them sell drugs, some of them are not involved in large criminal gangs, some are in MS-13, and then others have families who are in prison. And I'm wondering whether managed drug legalization could help cut down on the drug violence in U.S. cities and in Latin America.
This one for Vanda, I think.
Sure. I spend a lot of time working on drugs and co-direct at Brookings a project on global drug policy reform. So that's one of the questions we look at. And I would preface it by saying that U.S. policies that have criminalized low-level dealings and particular use have been disastrous. I think there is overwhelming agreement that they have neither cut down on use and have compounded a tremendous amount of problems, social problems, particularly with respect to minorities. So movements toward decriminalization of use, certainly not sentencing to prison people just on the basis of drug possession offenses and drug use offenses, is indeed the way that we need to go. There is movement in the United States and globally in that direction. That said, I'm not persuaded that legalization per se would resolve high criminality issues and issues of gang violence. Indeed, there are many economies around the world that are legal but are pervaded by illegality, corruption, and violence. For example, in places like Indonesia, logging is far more violent, logging and mining, than the illegal drug trade. We need to deploy much better strategies toward policing gangs. There is enormous wealth of lessons, such as on focused deterrence strategies, many pioneered in the United States and places like Boston, where really the anti-gang program has then been exported around the world and with often not equal successes. So definitely the criminalization of use, definitely not sending users into prison, thinking much more creatively, reducing penalties for low-level dealers, swift short penalties, such as Project Hope, some of the greatest effectiveness rates, but then focusing on other strategies, focused deterrent strategies to dealing with criminal violence, and with respect to young children or young people being recruited into gangs, a whole set of other interventions.
Unfortunately, we're basically out of time, but I want to give the ambassador a chance to respond on the question of Colombia's experience with legalization.
Well, legalization is a world debate, and I think one day economies will move on to find solutions policy-wise for, global leaders. But from the perspective we have had to confront, of course, it would be a lot easier for us to confront the fight on drugs if demand were to reduce. So I really care about, thinking about how, countries that are consumers can do policies to reduce consumption. Because at the end, even if you legalize or not, consumption of drugs usually drives violence. It's like a little bit of alcohol, There are things that usually contribute to environments of violence. So, reducing demand is very important. First, in our case, for that money not to go and fund terrorism, crime, and organized crime, But second, when I think about now cities, in the case of Colombia, where we have seen some increase in consumption from the youth population, I really care about thinking on policies to, allow people to do something else, like sports, culture, or something else that puts them out of consumption. Because consumption, anyway, deteriorates the environment of security and some kind of affects peaceful, a peaceful environment. That will be a little bit my comment.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to ask Mike to just give us a close-out sentence or two about securing global cities.
Well, I'll just thank everyone for coming, everyone here on the panel. I think the other piece of this whole enterprise that comes out to me, listening to my colleagues here, and especially the three who have done this in the real world for long periods of their time at a leadership role, is the importance of leadership. And I've seen this is a hard thing to put into a bottle or write about in a book and explain how to do it. You just have to have people who are capable. And what I've seen, I know there's great leadership capacity across this whole panel, but what I've personally had the privilege to watch General Odierno and Ambassador Pinzon do in the real world in practice underscores that to break down these barriers, to make these bureaucracies work, you need sometimes the right kind of leadership. And so that's just one more piece of the puzzle. I wish I knew how to quantify it or generate it or produce it, but it shouldn't go unsaid in this kind of a discussion.
Thank you. I want to thank General Odierno very much for taking a leadership role in this project, to Shankar and Ambassador Pinzon and to Vanda. Thank you all for contributing to what is a very rich conversation, and I think We all have a sense now of the importance of focusing on security in cities, and we're grateful to you all for that. Thank you all very much.